This is East End Inc. Today we present science writer and artist Erica Serino discussing her work Thicker Than Water, The Quest for Solutions to the Plastic Crisis. Ms. Serino is a fellow at the Safina Center at Stony Brook University. She was recorded at Canio's Books in Sag Harbor.
In my early work, I came across a lot of wild creatures who were injured or killed even by plastic. So this could be a plastic balloon string around a leg or a wing. It could be a fishing line that has gotten down an animal's throat and needs to be extracted. We've seen great horned owls stuck in soccer nets. It's been every kind of plastic situation that you could imagine. And many of them were fatal. So as I proceeded to continue this work for quite a number of years, I kind of got sick of just treating the symptoms of the problems. And most of those problems were caused by people, whether it was the plastic issue, animals being poisoned, hit by vehicles, displaced from habitat destruction. So there were a lot of things going on that I thought would be important to prevent them rather than just treat the symptom the rest of my life. I had planned to become some kind of wildlife biologist or field expert or rehabilitator in my career. And that actually changed around the time when I met Carl. I was taking also at the time an environmental literature class. And I realized I could also use maybe my creative skills to communicate these problems so that fewer animals would have to go through what the patients I saw in the clinic were going through on a daily basis. Fast forward a little bit, when I was in college, I quit the job at the wildlife hospital. I started doing freelance writing and graphic illustrations and photography. And so I was offered to go on this trip, and it was definitely the trip of a lifetime. So I boarded a very simple steel sloop with 8 others. There were 7 Danes, scientists and sailors. We sailed through the garbage patch. I always ask people, what do you think of when you think of the garbage patch? And the answer I most often get is a floating island of garbage in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. And it turns out it is absolutely nothing like that. It actually mostly looks like a clean blue sea with large items floating by. This is a fishing buoy. There were big tangles of nets and ropes, which we refer to as ghost fishing gear. So fishing gear is quite often lost or discarded at sea. And animals also just get caught and actively use fishing gear. But when it does detach from a ship and gets out of the hands of humans, it tends to kind of find other nets and ropes and creates these impossible to untangle amalgamations of rope and net and traps and different things. And it's just this really deadly floating mine almost, where an animal, if it swims into this, it'll get entangled, possibly lethally, often lethally. The scientists I was with, they were with an organization called Plastic Change, and we also had a scientist from Roskilde University in Denmark. And so our purpose when we were out there was to understand the scope of this problem. So what is the garbage patch? What is it composed of? How much plastic is there? These are just some of the many questions that the scientists were trying to answer. So here you see a close-up of a metal sieve, and inside are plastic particles along with a lot of plankton and other biological matter. That's kind of the brownish stuff, probably some fish eggs too in there. But that colorful and white confetti looking stuff, that is actually plastic. And so plastic, unlike many other materials, it never ever will fully degrade or decompose into simpler elements. It will remain plastic. It will just get smaller and smaller in size. And the main concern here is that you can see in this very sieve that the fish eggs and the little plankton creatures, they're about the same size as the plastic. So you think of a whale, and a whale that eats tons, maybe 10 tons of food a day. And, you know, some filter feeders keep their mouths open and just kind of swallow water as they go along, these giant whales. But other creatures too, like mussels, filter feed. And they can't always, some can, but many cannot control whether or not they take in something that's the same size as the food that they're supposed to eat. Some animals like coral have the ability to spit things out if it's not food. And yet many animals are eating plastic, and it's a growing concern to the point where it seems like almost every creature has eaten plastic at some point, including humans. So here you see plastic that we encountered. So we, to go along with this trip, we sailed across the garbage patch, saw a lot of plastic at sea. We scooped our nets and equipment into the water and found microplastic, which is the scientific name for any piece of plastic that's broken up into a piece that's 5 millimeters in diameter or smaller. And so we made it to the Hawaiian Islands. It was a harrowing journey that I detail in the book. I won't give much away because I think you have to read it to fully understand the situation we were in, but it was essentially our boat was disabled for a while and we had to cross part of the Pacific Ocean, which was not easy. Anyway, once we made it past that, we were checking out the Hawaiian Islands and came across a group called Hawaii Wildlife Fund. And Hawaii Wildlife Fund has been doing beach cleanups on one particular stretch of beach on the Big Island of Hawaii for more than a decade now, and have been going almost every weekend to clear trash because it's just simply so much plastic that washes up. From the coast of California to the Hawaiian Islands, this is known as the Eastern North Pacific Gyre or the Eastern Garbage Patch. And so there's a water current there that's circulating in a clockwise motion, and it's spinning a lot of debris and trash that's collected in the ocean from the coast of California, the coast of Asia, and Hawaii itself, all the way to South America. There's trash circulating in the ocean. So when it is pushed by a current and comes up to the garbage patch, this particular current on the eastern side, it just swirls around and around. So there's a lot of trash in this region. So understanding that point brings me back here. The Big Island of Hawaii kind of juts out on the bottom. And so the gyre spins and dumps a lot of trash directly on a point called Kamilo Beach on that southern tip of the Big Island. And to the point where you can literally put your hand in the water and just scoop out microplastic. So this is all microplastic, and that poor dog is going for a swim in what is a plastic soup. And so this is a really great picture in the sense that it shows the breakup of plastic really well. I mean, all that white and colorful stuff is microplastic. Kamilo Beach is just totally strewn with plastic, and it doesn't matter how many times groups like Hawaii Wildlife Fund come to clean up, it's always going to come back unless we stop using plastic. And we know this because this group has been doing these beach cleanups, as I said, for more than a decade, almost every weekend. And the amounts of plastic just keep getting greater and greater. I mean, they pull 14, 15, 16 tons of plastic off this beach every year, which is a remarkable amount of trash. And especially because it's all people power doing this. So that's really an amazing thing. But again, this group acknowledges cleanups are not the answer. There needs to be something else done, or else we're just going to do this for the rest of our lives. And it comes at great cost to the wildlife living in this region and all over the world. But specifically, if we're talking about Hawaii, we have a lot of endangered species. We have a lot of marine species. Monk seals routinely come up on this beach. They're one of the endangered species. And the presence of plastic sometimes deters them from coming up on shore to rest. And I've heard the same with turtles, sea turtles. So hawksbills and green sea turtles on the Hawaiian Islands have suffered greatly because of the plastic issue. So this microplastic that you see, when it gets onto the sand, it's pretty much almost indistinguishable, some of it from sand grains, because if it's light colored plastic, but you can see sometimes the colorful pieces and it tells you, okay, this is not quite as natural as it is, as it seems. So there's a ton of plastic on the beach, and that's a problem because A, it's releasing climate warming gases. And that's a new finding that scientists have been trying to amplify, because if there's plastic all around us constantly releasing methane and other greenhouse gases, we could have a serious problem on our hands because we have a lot of plastic lying around. What's more is that the presence of plastic on a beach changes the temperature of the sand. So sea turtles that try to lay eggs might end up with a completely feminized population of sea turtles, or a completely male population, depending on the temperature. But as climate change intensifies as the plastic on the beach piles up, the temperature of the sand increases dramatically, and that could leave sea turtles without partners to mate with if they all turn into one gender. Even when animals are not stuffed to the gills with plastic, animals that have plastic inside of them. So this was a mahi-mahi we caught out in the garbage patch. And it had two little plastic pellets in its stomach. So these are kind of raw plastic pellets, or the plastic that's manufactured and then melted down to make the items that we use. So that was kind of a chilling moment to cut open this fish and find plastic inside and then go ahead and eat the fish. I learned a lot more after that point, which may or may not have influenced my decision to eat the fish in that moment. You know, we were living on a really simple boat where most meals came out of cans or bags or boxes. So fresh food was really a rare thing out there. So when we found the plastic, it led to a discussion of why, you know, is this concerning? You know, should we eat this fish, et cetera? The normal questions you might ask when you find garbage inside of an animal that you're about to eat. So we talked about it, and our expert on board, Christian Suberg, was telling us that plastic particles, especially microplastic, could contain toxic chemicals. And some of these chemicals are manufactured into the plastic, and some of these chemicals are picked up in the surrounding environment. So if you have water that has pesticides in it, or soil that's laced with heavy metals, the plastic might pick it up. And then because it's so easily transported by water, wind, animals, people, it could poison us as well. So we don't know, though, how strong this effect is because there are limited studies. My understanding is right now there's a lot of research happening or trying to answer these questions. But we went ahead and ate that fish, even though we know that the risk of having animals inside of, plastic inside of animals leads to a risk of contamination with toxic chemicals. So when I went to Denmark, the first lab at Roskilde University, that was the step that I took to understand, okay, what's the chemical issue here? So I ran some tests using a machine called an FTIR machine. It's a spectroscopy machine for any scientists out there. And that basically shoots a beam of light at the plastic and reflects back into the machine, and there's a wavelength of light that reflects back. And that wavelength gives you kind of a curve, and it tells you, if you're a scientist, and you match it up to other curves that are known, you know, the known infrared spectrums of these materials, you can find out what item did this plastic, tiny plastic, microplastic piece, I have my microplastic ready here, what item did it come from? So was it from a bag, a bottle, some styrofoam, you know, there are different types of plastic that we use. Not all of them are the same formulation. So based on this kind of research, we can get a better understanding of which items are ending up in the environment, which are ending up as microplastic, and maybe what legislation or actions can we take to prevent those specific items from causing the bulk of this issue. We find a lot of single-use plastics that are in the water. So these are the plastics that are in plastic bags, bottles, et cetera. So in terms of the fate of plastic, so we know that these plastic particles have the toxins that are manufactured into them, the toxins they pick up in the environment. We know that scientists are now trying to understand where it comes from, but now we're understanding where also does this plastic go. And it turns out that we breathe plastic in our homes at a rate of about 11 particles per hour. I learned this from scientists in Denmark that were at a different university called Aarhus University.
This is East End Inc. We are listening to Erica Serino discuss her book, Thicker Than Water, The Quest for Solutions to the Plastic Crisis.
Generally, we've been using more and more plastic as time has gone on, to the point where there's at least 8.3 billion metric tons of plastic made today, and at least 6.3 billion of those 8.3 billion metric tons, so this is most of that, has ended up in the environment or landfills. which is a huge concern because if we're living on top of our trash, what are the risks to our health if we know that it's going to break up into these little particles that easily enter food, that are easily eaten by animals that we eat as well? It's in our water, it's in the air outside as well. You know, there have been many studies in the past 5 to 10 years revealing the extent of this problem. And it's only really recently that this has happened. Although I learned from scientists, some of the old time scientists, the originals who were starting this research in the 70s, shortly after plastic had begun to be mass produced. Edward Carpenter is one of them, and he had found plastic particles in seabirds with a collaborator. He had found plastic particles in the surface waters of the oceans. And representatives of the plastic industry apparently came to his door and told him not to publish some of his work. And he was working at Woods Hole at the time. And he told me that he was really concerned, but he also knew that he wanted to publish his research. And he thinks that he did not get tenure because that he pushed forward with his research and that the industry complained and made problems for Woods Hole. So that was really upsetting to hear because it's like, you know, I spoke to him and I spoke to several other scientists who had been doing work around the same time in the 60s and 70s. And they were aware of the problem, of course, not the whole scale of it, but they knew that the problem was happening. And they lament today, you know, could we have solved this problem 70 years ago, or at least, you know, started to work on solving it, because maybe we would have been much further today. If we're getting to solutions, how do we handle this waste? Because currently we create an enormous amount of waste, almost an impossible amount. It turns out only 9% of all the plastic we've made historically has been recycled. And this number is a bit dubious because recycling numbers are self-reported, most commonly by municipalities, by waste handlers, and trash is cash. I mean, I hear this in communities all over that are working on zero waste solutions, but unfortunately, much of this trash is ending up near or in communities of color or indigenous communities who face an increased level of pollution. Why does this happen? Well, there's systemic racism for one, which pushes corporations to make these decisions. It also sways the municipalities charged with protecting people in their communities to accept projects like giant incinerators and recycling centers, landfills, waste transfer stations. The list goes on and on. Here on Long Island, we have a community in Brookhaven facing the issues of a landfill right now in North Bellport. And strangely, and I've learned this as I've become more active with their group, there's an incinerator in my current community that sends ash to their community. And there are several other communities with incinerators that also send trash to North Bellport, to the Brookhaven landfill. So it really, waste is a strange thing because it really connects all of us. And the issue of injustice is a critical place to, I think, begin this this quest for solutions, as I call it, because it just reiterates the fact that there is no such place as away with plastic. I mean, it's going to have to go somewhere. And unfortunately, for many people, that means in their own backyards, at the expense of their health, also at the expense of their mental well-being, their financial stability. You know, if you're living next to one of these trash handling places, your home value is probably not going to be as high as people who are further afield. So there are many consequences for these communities. Rarely do communities have a say in whether such developments happen, because oftentimes there's a real lack of transparency. And so it's not even like these communities can choose whether or not they want to have this stuff there. It's that it just gets there for some reason. And then they find out about it and have to react. So that's also really part of it too, part of the injustice that needs to be changed. So increasing that transparency is a really great place to start. So I spoke to a bunch of scientists and residents in Turkey last year. They were telling me that their community in Adana, which is a port city, were suffering because of the waste crisis, the plastic crisis, because communities in the UK and other parts of Europe, they were sending their trash to Turkey to be dumped or incinerated. And it was under the guise of recycling. So oftentimes, you know, projects that are called renewable or recycling, it's just not true, because there's nothing renewable about burning trash for energy. In fact, it requires fossil fuels to do that. It also requires fossil fuels to, you know, have cargo ships full of trash, you know, travel around the world. So it just seems like the trash was just set on fire. And I've worked with Dr. Sedat Gondogdu, and he is a researcher in Turkey who's actually mapped these facilities that have caught fire, and it's just like dozens of them. And it makes you wonder, you're like, okay, well, the people who are accepting the recycling are getting money for it, and they're not recycling it because that's expensive. So they're just gonna burn it and say that there was an accident. So you see what the narrative is there. There is more environmental racism at the front of the plastic pipeline. And that was where my journey took me in my book as well. So you'll meet the folks in Welcome, Louisiana, in St. James Parish. On the way there, I drove past so many refineries, other industrial developments. So there's an 85-mile stretch of land between Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and New Orleans. And it's filled with more than 150 refineries, factories, and other industrial infrastructure, mostly fossil fuel based and plastic based. And as the climate crisis intensifies, as emissions regulations are more stringent, renewable energy is coming on the map. What we hear is that the oil and gas companies are now banking on making plastic as a way to use fossil fuels into the future, because they're not necessarily burning all of them, although some needs to be burned for energy to make them, but turning oil and gas, which is the foundational blocks of plastic, into plastic. And so again, these giant colossal factories, which can be thousands of acres, are often right next door to communities of color, which is a major environmental justice concern. You know, I encountered all different types of factories on my journey, but the real change was happening at that time. Even though the situation feels so dire, there are communities out there fighting back. And so Rise St. James is a group founded by Sharon Levine. She's a 2021 Goldman Environment Prize winner for her amazing work in St. James. But she's rallied her whole community to stand up to the corporations, most recently being Taiwanese Formosa Plastic Group. So Formosa Plastic Group came in with a proposed $9.4 billion plastic factory. And you heard that right, billion dollar. And these corporations have an enormous amount of money, and to think they're putting these developments in the most vulnerable communities is just really disgusting and disturbing. And that's what Sharon's work is shedding light on. You can see her here next to Diane Wilson in the red cape. So Diane lives in Seadrift, Texas, next to an existing Formosa facility. And she's encountered plastic raining down from the sky, plastic in the waterways, explosions, fires, you name it, endless disasters in her own community. So she's been allying with Rise and kind of shedding light on, you know, how she fought off Formosa. She didn't succeed, obviously, in getting them to leave Seadrift, Texas, where she is, but she did succeed in one of the biggest class action settlements for the Clean Air Act, because they were found to be polluting. And Clean Water Act, they were found to be polluting. And so the waterways in her community were completely saturated with plastic pellets and plastic pieces. And so all the work detecting that issue was all on Diane and her neighbors, who went in kayaks into these water outflows to collect these plastic particles and then presented thousands of bags of them to the judge in court. So, well, you have to educate your community. It's really hard to stay on top of all the things that these corporations are doing, because there's a lot of permits, there's a lot of deals, there's money that comes and goes. And there's also the local legislators and regulators who are supposed to be in charge of making sure their pollution levels are not above what is deemed acceptable. So Formosa's application says that it will operate within DEC and EPA guidelines. The DEQ, Louisiana DEQ guidelines. However, you know, these residents have serious concerns because look at Formosa's track record. You know, you look at Diane's situation in Texas, and they were literally having plastic snowing down from the sky. That's a real big problem. So when we address the issue of plastic, it's not just an issue of what can we use to replace plastic? What can we use, you know, instead of plastic? These common narratives, how can we clean it up? But it's really a fundamental value shift that we need, and a fundamental look at accountability. And it's not just, you know, making the corporations that make plastic accountable, but it's also holding ourselves accountable. We all, not all of us, but most people alive today participate in a very fast-paced lifestyle, a very wasteful lifestyle. Plastic is a great material in terms of its ability to be so versatile, so lightweight, very inexpensive in most cases. It's also capable of saving lives. I mean, you know, we have helmets, we have airbags, we have syringes. We think of the coronavirus pandemic and all the PPE that we've had. And it's exhausting at the same time because it's literally everything in our world. I often speak to young people, and I remember there was one student who was really freaked out once I told them that, you know, the ceiling in their school was made of plastic, the floor was made of plastic, the table was made of plastic, their chair was made of plastic, their shoes, their shirt, and then the water bottle on the table, and that poor student was just looking mortified. But that's the reality of the world we live in.
This is East End Inc. We heard science writer and artist Erica Serino discussing her book Thicker Than Water, The Quest for Solutions to the Plastic Crisis. The book was published by Island Press. Ms. Serino is a fellow at the Safina Center at Stony Brook University. She's a recipient of several fellowships, including from the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution and the Safina Center. She was recorded at Caneo's Books, Sag Harbor. Upcoming literary events on the East End include on Sunday, July 31st at 5 p.m., Louis Menand on The Free World, Art and Thought in the Cold War, hosted by the Pollock Krasner House. See their website for information. On Thursday, August 25th at 5:30 p.m., author Lauren Young speaks about Hitler's Girl, the British Aristocracy and the Third Reich on the eve of World War II. That's at Caneo's Books, Sag Harbor. More events are listed at caneosbooks.com. East End Inc. programs are archived at moreeastendinc.blogspot.com. East End Inc. was produced by Tony Ernst with the aid of Catherine Soka and Marianne Callendrew.